Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a new poll shows Pennsylvanians are very concerned about affording health care. And state legislative Democrats want Republicans held accountable for election fraud rhetoric and any part they may have played in the protests that led to the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. But up front, the COVID-19 vaccination rollout in Pennsylvania has been haphazard. And as a result, getting shots into arms hasn't been efficient, and there's confusion about how those who are eligible can actually get a vaccination. Part of the problem has been there aren't enough doses to accommodate everyone who is eligible and wants a shot. But logistics and planning have held up shots, too. Last week, a task force was formed to study and recommend ways to improve the vaccine rollout. It's made up of the acting Secretary of Health and the head of the State Emergency Management Agency, along with a member of each of the legislative caucuses. State Senator Ryan Almond of Lancaster County represents the Republican Senate caucus and is with us today. Senator Almond, when many people hear task force, they think, oh no, another task force and more government bureaucracy. Will the COVID-19 vaccine joint task force be different?
Well, thanks, Scott, for having me. Yes, I think it will be. And thus far, we have held two meetings. We have a third meeting today. And I have to tell you, I'm very grateful for the governor, for the administration taking this approach. I think it's important to have more voices at the table, not less, to have dissenting views of the table. But for all of us working together in a collaborative way, to work together in a bipartisan way, to ensure that we are designing and implementing the most efficient vaccination program that that we can. That's our collective goal. I've been pleased with the meetings, the sessions that we've held thus far. The governor's been very interested in our input. I have certainly taken the approach at the outset, trying to gather as much information as I can. So it gives me an opportunity to provide feedback to the governor, to the acting secretary, to the director of PEMA, but then for me also to communicate back, for me to communicate back to the members of my caucus and to communicate with the broader public as well, so that we're speaking with one voice. So I'm very optimistic at the outset that this is going to be a meaningful task force that's going to help ensure Pennsylvania's on the right track.
What's happened during those two meetings that makes you optimistic?
Well, first, I'm optimistic with the speed that the governor moved. I mean, this has been an approach that I've been urging, quite frankly, since March, as we began, as we initiated our COVID response, as I thought that it would be helpful, particularly in a time of crisis, that we bring all parties together at the table in a meaningful way to collaborate, to have, again, to have dissenting views of the table, but then to ensure that we put in place two-way communication, that we're communicating to our respective caucuses, the Senate Republican caucus, who I'm representing on the task force, as well as the broader public, and that I have an opportunity to bring ideas and feedback to the governor, to the administration. So I'm pleased that the governor moved very quickly. I received a call last Wednesday, I believe it was Wednesday morning. The governor announced the task force by that afternoon, and we held our first meeting on Friday afternoon. We met again yesterday afternoon on President's Day, and then we have a meeting again today. We've met for each of those sessions has lasted an hour. The governor has been very engaged. He has asked each individual member for their priorities, for their feedback. We've had an opportunity to hear from the secretary to really better understand the challenges with respect to supply, and those challenges certainly persist, and then collectively come together with a strategy as to how we can get these vaccinations out in the most effective and efficient manner, ensuring that we're developing larger sustained clinics, which has been a priority of mine in Lancaster County as we've looked at a mass vaccination site, but to also ensure that we have equity, that we are reaching those hard to reach, more vulnerable populations. So I've been pleased with the speed the governor's acted. I've been very pleased with the quality of the conversations. And so I am optimistic about this task force and for Pennsylvania seeing a dramatic improvement because, again, the people expect, deserve, and demand results.
Senator, you have been critical up until this point of the rollout for some of the reasons that you just mentioned. Speed, obviously, is one of the keys here. I mean, how can, okay, if you see this as progress with the vaccine joint task force making recommendations, listening to all sides, but how do we actually put it into action to get more shots into arms?
Yeah, so the fundamental challenge, no question, the fundamental challenge that remains is supply. And I think we're going to continue to see improvement there. But Pennsylvania is currently receiving about 175,000 doses statewide. That falls well short of the demand here in Pennsylvania. But what I have been urging for the last number of weeks up to my appointment with the my appointment to the task force is that we bring expertise to the table, that we bring private sector expertise. I called for about a week and a half ago, I called for a vaccination quote-unquote czar, sort of a policy lead that has real logistical and operational planning and expertise. This is something that is that vaccination distribution on such a scale that I think exceeds government's expertise. And so I think bringing outside voices, bringing some of that private sector expertise to the table, that's something the governor has been interested in. They have the governor's working with, the task force is working with a consulting firm out of Boston. The governor's been very engaged in bringing other folks to the table, the hospitals and health systems, the Pennsylvania Chamber, folks who've got real expertise. So that's something that I'm interested in. I'm pleased the governor has a real interest in doing that. The governor has a real interest in ensuring that we are distributing to these larger sustainable clinics, and while also then ensuring that we have equity. So there's certainly some improvement to be made in terms of how we are distributing the allocation statewide. But the fundamental issue remains is increasing the supply that we're receiving from the federal government from Operation Warp Speed.
And let me tell our listeners at home that if you have a question or a comment for Senator Ahmed about the vaccine rollout, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You mentioned that, Senator, you have proposed a vaccine rollout czar or whatever we would call that. Czar is a word that gets a lot of use nowadays for some reason in government. But anyway, that this person would have a military background in logistics, that organization, the military, obviously very organized. Would this person have a military background that you're proposing?
Well, that's certainly from my perspective, that's not a requirement. However, I do think the military senior officers, generals in my background is military prior to becoming into elective office, serving in combat in 2003, 2004. And so certainly the operational planning, the logistical expertise that's required, a very senior non-commissioned officer or a military officer certainly would have the ability to help us do that, as well as folks from the private sector. Fortune 500 company CEOs who have real experience in logistical planning. I'll give you an example. In Lancaster County, we are in process of developing a mass vaccination site at the Bonton, the site of at Park City, where we believe with supply, we have the capacity to do 5,000, maybe 6,000 vaccinations a day on that site. There are a number of key players involved, government entities at all levels, state partners, municipal partners, county officials, as well as our Lancaster County Chamber of Commerce has been involved in the planning. And all four health systems in Lancaster County have come together behind this plan. But a key feature, I think, of this plan is this outside expertise that I'm talking about. We've got folks, for example, from our Rock-Lititz campus that have real experience putting together large live events, and they've brought real expertise to bear to help develop this plan. So that's really what I've suggested for a statewide quote unquote vaccination czar. I'm not wedded to any specific approach to that. What I conveyed to the governor during our meeting on Friday was just the point that we need to ensure that government is receiving outside advice and counsel and leveraging the expertise that we have available to us here in the Commonwealth, whether that be a military point person or team of folks or whether that be folks from the private sector. And the governor's been very engaged. In fact, our meeting later today, we're talking about, we're going to have a discussion around partners, folks that can partner with us that have this type of expertise. So I explained to the governor with the task force model, as well as the outside consultant that's advising the Department of Health, the administration, the task force. I'm interested in results, whatever's going to enable us to make the most efficient allocation and dramatically increase our ability to get vaccinations to the people, all those who want vaccination across the Commonwealth. That's my priority.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Signing up to get vaccinated and getting an appointment. I mean, quite frankly, it's been a nightmare for many people, calling doctors, pharmacies, counties, the state, legislators, people going to another county. We have a question from a listener that falls into this. Why not have a centralized sign up for Pennsylvania? Having to call or check multiple websites does not work for most people.
No, I agree. And that's certainly something that I intend to bring up in the context of our conversations with the task force to date. And again, we've had two meetings. Our third meeting is today. And most of the conversation has centered on the allocation from the federal government, understanding the various federal programs, as well as metrics to measure results and making decisions in terms to how those allocations should be made across the Commonwealth and outside partners, as we've discussed. So to date, we've not yet discussed the sign-up portals. I believe having a statewide database that then feeds countywide systems would be of some benefit. I've not had that conversation yet with the governor or with the acting secretary of health. I know there's legislation that's been introduced recently that would require the state to set up a centralized database. I think whichever statewide platform we create, I think it's important that is speaking to the countywide systems. I know there are a number of counties that have developed their own systems. So we need to make sure that we create a platform that is communicating to counties, communicating with our hospitals and health systems, and we don't create additional confusion.
Let's take a phone call from James in Selins Grove. James, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm a family physician with Family Practice Center. We're a large, almost 40 clinic, private practice all across Central PA. And we had originally been giving the vaccine, and we feel like the rug is pulled out from under us with this new guideline that they're going to shift it to big centers and pharmacies. I feel that a lot of our patients that are elderly and have trouble navigating are better in our hands than they are in this current system. And I would just like a little bit more of an explanation about that.
All right. Thank you very much, James. And this is something I did want to bring up, Senator. Just this week, the Department of Health has announced that it will reduce the number of places or the number of, I don't know, the numbers that can actually hand out the vaccinations, do the vaccinations, not the actual numbers. There will still be the same number of vaccinations, but physicians, family physicians, are not one of those. And heard from James, a family physician, heard from the association that represents family doctors, that say that, you know, there are some people in Pennsylvania have their best relationship is with their family doctor rather than a pharmacy. There are places in rural areas that may not have pharmacies that are close by or a hospital that is close by. So why take it away from the family physicians? And I know there are some others that have been taken away as well. But why take it away from family physicians having the ability to vaccinate people?
Well, I can certainly speak from my own experience. My relationship with my family practice and my family physician is a stronger relationship than with my local pharmacy. So I can certainly empathize with those who take that view. As I understand it from the, and I don't want to speak for the acting secretary, but as I understand it, this is a temporary pivot. We are all adjusting, trying to most effectively and efficiently drive out vaccination with the limited supply. As I've suggested, the demand exceeds supply significantly by 500,000. We're receiving about 175,000 doses a week currently. And so I think this pivot is really an attempt to make sure that we are driving out the most vaccines in the most efficient and effective manner. So I think it is this reflects a temporary pivot to a narrower scope of vaccinators. But I think as we see, again, I don't want to speak for the secretary, but my sense is from the comments that I've heard from her, as well as what she stated publicly, is that this is temporary. As the vaccination supply increases, that we will then see more vaccination go out beyond the large clinics, beyond the health clinics, beyond the pharmacies, and back to family providers.
We have a tweet here from Lance that says, you can't blame the number of doses supply on the feds as long as Pennsylvania is sitting on doses and Pennsylvania is getting doses that aren't getting into arms. We have seen the numbers, Senator, and I don't know about what the current ones are, but there are a lot of doses that haven't made their way into arms. Is that a problem?
I think it's a problem that we are working to address. I mean, certainly, again, the task force is very new. My first meeting was on Friday. Looking forward to the third session today. So I need to be candid. I'm still working very hard to get my arms around all of this so that I'm providing appropriate feedback to the governor as well as to my constituents. I don't think any of us are satisfied with Pennsylvania's current position, and we are committed to working in a bipartisan way to improving dramatically the effectiveness and the efficiency of our distribution. I think it's important to note also that as we work to improve and bring greater accountability, and that's part of the conversation and the work that we've been doing the last couple of days, is to put in place real metrics to measure success. We want to make sure that we are maintaining a commitment here in Pennsylvania that if you've received your first dose, that you will receive your second dose, that you will receive a second dose according to CDC guidelines. But we do need to hold providers accountable. We need to hold the Commonwealth accountable for getting allocations out quickly. And then once those allocations have been made to providers, that those vaccinations are received by anyone who wishes to receive one in a very short period of time. So holding the Commonwealth, holding providers accountable for results is important. And I think it's also important that we have the supply, that we're able to first maintain our commitment to those that have received the first dose and then need to receive a second dose within the appropriate CDC window.
I hope, Senator, that you know, some of the suggestions you're getting from listeners today is something that you can take with you when you do have a task force meeting. Another question from a listener wants to know, are you looking at what other states are doing? There are a lot of states that are doing much better with the rollout in their states than Pennsylvania is. Will the task force, or is the task force, looking at what is working and maybe not working in other states?
Absolutely, we are. We are very interested in what Pennsylvania's ranking is nationally, those that are performing better, why they're performing better, understanding that and bringing best practices to bear. And to your point, Scott, absolutely. One of the benefits of having been named to the task force is that I'm receiving feedback from folks, from providers, from experts in the field, as well as patients, residents who've had experience with signing up and great frustration with the vaccination process as it currently exists. I'm receiving feedback, not just from my constituents, from folks all across the Commonwealth. So certainly as I'm hearing from your listeners here today and taking notes, part of the reason the task force was developed was so that we could take this feedback back to the Secretary of Health, back to the governor, back to the task force for discussion and then act on that. Because again, we're all interested in results and improving. And certainly part of that is looking to the experience of other states and who's performing better than Pennsylvania.
Senator, I read a quote from you in LNP, the Lancaster newspaper, saying that you were asking about the low share of vaccine distributions in Lancaster County in particular, since that's your constituency, but you didn't get a clear answer. We've already heard from a few listeners as well saying that communication and getting clear answers has been part of the problem. How can that be changed?
Well, I'm hopeful that the task force will aid in that process. So just I suggested to in response to a previous question, a previous caller, taking feedback back to the governor, back to the Secretary of Health. I certainly see a key role of this task force to then communicate back to the broader public as we have these conversations, as we have these discussions and ask questions, to take information back to the public. Transparency in the information flow is key here. So as we understand what the statewide allocation is, as methodology is being changed, as we discussed earlier, a real emphasis on finding a balance between equity as well as larger sustained clinics like a mass vaccination site that we're working on in Lancaster. And as those allocations shift, we need to make sure that we are communicating that back to the public. And I certainly have urged the governor, the Secretary of Health, as have my colleagues in the task force, have certainly encouraged the administration on communicating very, very clearly with people, being very clear about, as I've said, our commitment to the second dose within CDC guidelines. That's an important balance that has to be struck. That's a challenge this week, I can tell you, with the total number of allocations we've received and the demand for that second dose. Is a significant portion of that total allocation. So we have to maintain that commitment and be sure that we communicate with the public what the appropriate window is to receive that second dosage. So, just to repeat, the feedback, taking the feedback from folks in the field, taking that back to the task force, but then communicating back to the broader public, I think is a critical role of the task force.
I saw a letter this morning to the editor now, MP, Leading Edge Pennsylvania, says that your task force is a start. But they say, and you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, Senator, that more people are needed at the table, more expertise. Would you agree with that?
No question. And that's the conversation that we're going to have. As I look at the agenda for the task force meeting this morning, is to talk about those partners that need to have a seat at the table, the folks that we need to be hearing from, our hospitals and health systems, the chamber, certainly Leading Edge, the folks that work with our nursing facility administrators and medical professionals at our nursing facilities. We need to hear from those folks, our family physicians, our pharmacists. All these are folks that need to have a seat at the table. Folks expect and demand and deserve results. And I think, as I've said throughout our COVID response, more voices at the table are better.
Senator, we're also getting a lot of emails from folks who are asking if the task force will look at 1A, 1B, you know, 1C, the different levels. We have one listener said that, she's asthmatic and she's not considered part of 1A. I mean, it almost sounds like it would be starting from scratch to redesignate who belongs in 1A, 1B and all that. But is that something that you will be looking at?
We have not yet. I do think that certainly, again, is something the task force has to take a look at, to take that feedback from folks back to the governor, to the Department of Health, to the task force for conversation. You're right. I certainly am not advocating that we start from scratch. But as the information is provided as to where folks fall in this rollout, that we are being thoughtful about that and that we continue to look to make improvements, make improvement as necessary. As you've said, there's been a lot of conversation recently about the prioritization of our educators, our classroom teachers, and how essential this vaccination potentially is to being able to safely reopen our schools, where schools are challenged to follow all the CDC guidelines to safely reopen. So I think these are conversations absolutely the task force has to have, not starting from scratch, but as this information is made available to the public and we receive feedback from folks, that we're taking that back to the task force, to the governor, to the secretary for conversation and for consideration.
Republican State Senator Ryan Aumann of Lancaster County. He's with the vaccine task force that was just formed, named by Governor Wolf last week. Senator, hopefully something will come of this, that where we can get more vaccinations out there, and it will be done more quickly. But, Senator, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate your interest.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about term limits for legislators. That's coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk. Democrats in the State House and Senate are renewing calls for Republicans who were at the Capitol protest that turned into an insurrection on January 6th in Washington, and those who used election fraud rhetoric, to be held accountable. Joining us to talk about that is Democratic State Representative Jordan Harris of Philadelphia. Representative Harris, thank you for being with us today. What are Democrats in the legislature looking for?
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me on the program. What we're looking for is accountability. First and foremost, we're looking for my colleagues to admit that this was a free and fair election, that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris won this free and fair election, and to basically stop the lies that have continued to poison the well for our constituents across the Commonwealth, and frankly, this narrative that has been spawned across this country. So, you know, for me, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about accountability, and we're talking about being honest with voters on what happened in November.
But when you say accountability and what you just described, I mean, if a Republican legislator who signed on to one of those letters, for example, that called into question Pennsylvania's electoral votes, if that legislator came out and said, I'm sorry, I was wrong, that this was a free and fair election, is that all you're looking for? Are you looking for something concrete, something solid, that those who spread these lies or those who signed on to it, that in some way they would be held accountable, punished, in other words?
Well, here's what I'll say. If you were at the Capitol and if you traveled inside the Capitol and were a part of the actual insurrection, then yes, there should be recourse for those actions, absolutely. What happened in Washington, D.C. was a coup. It was an attempted coup to overthrow the United States government by stopping the certification of free and fair elections. It was an attempt to suppress the votes of hundreds of millions of Americans throughout this country. And it must be called exactly that. So those who stepped foot on the Capitol grounds and did so, yes, they are and have committed treasonous acts against this country. But for my colleagues in the legislature who were not there, who have helped spawn the lies, there's an accountability there as well. But what I'm saying is it first starts with an acknowledgement, one, that these were lies, and two, that people were wrong, and that they knew it, and that they continue to spread this misinformation intentionally.
What happens if they don't do that?
Well, here's a problem. If they don't, listen, this isn't just the normal political discourse that we go through. Like, you know, Democrats, Republicans, you agree on this, you disagree on that. That is the normal discourse that comes from our body politic. Actually, I think our voters appreciate that. What we're talking about now goes to the core of our democracy. When you begin to spread lies around what happened on election day, you go to the heart of who we are as a people, the heart of who we are as a country, the heart of who we are as a government. When you sow seeds of dissension into that process, you go beyond the normal course of political debate, and you go to creating harm that may not be able to be repaired to this democracy. So, like, I think that's how we have to address this. So when you say what happens if they don't, I think people are going to have to see the crumbling of our democracy and see that they are the ones with the axe chipping away at its foundation.
I mean, at the very least, some have suggested that what the Republicans who questioned the election and maybe did spread the fraud lie, what they've done is sow doubt in future elections, that those who vote won't have confidence in that their vote is counted and that the elections are free. I'm sure that's something you agree with.
I absolutely agree. But that's why, you know, folks need to tell the truth. Like I said, that my mother and my grandmother used to say, tell the truth and shame the devil. And here's what I mean by that. And here's how this is the discernment that our voters should glean from this. I was there on swearing in day for the House of Representatives. I raised my hand to take an oath. And I was there for every member that's got sworn in on election day. I was there for everyone. What I did not see is one person object. What I did not see on the other side of the aisle is one person not willing to take their oath. Well, why is that important? How is it that the Biden-Harris results in your mind are fraudulent, but you didn't object to your own election? We were on the same ballot. How is it that you didn't stand in protest when it came time for you to be sworn in? We were on the same ballot. So wait, there was fraud at the top of the ticket, but there was nothing at the congressional level. There was nothing at the state senator level. There was nothing at the state representative level. There was nothing at the level of auditor general, who is now a Republican. There's nothing at the level of state treasurer, who is now a Republican. So, you know, that's how we know, like, these are lies. It's sowing seeds of deception, because if you believed it, if you are a patriot, if you stand on the side of righteousness, why did you raise your hand and take the oath on your swearing in day if you believe that that election was fraudulent?
Representative Harris, I'm curious, what's going on behind the scenes in the legislature? I mean, has this driven a wedge between Democrats and Republicans? I mean, as you said, you disagree. I mean, that's part of our government. It's an adversarial form of government. But has it driven a bigger wedge between Republicans and Democrats, I mean, even on a personal basis?
Sadly, I've seen our body politic become hyperpartisan. And it didn't just start now. Even in the midst of great accomplishments in a bipartisan fashion, through the years of the previous Trump administration, with Trump as president, there have, in my view, have been some moving apart politically with regards to the parties. This, in my view, goes beyond the pale, though. Like I said, this is not your average political disagreement. You know, we can disagree and yell on the floor and then afterwards still go and dine as brothers and sisters, trying to do what's right for our common good, being the Commonwealth. This is people saying that the metrics by which we all get here to serve, which is an election, was fraudulent. And in some instances, not all, but in some instances, that has drawn a wedge between some members. And it's unfortunate because, you know, as we are still in the middle of a pandemic, as we are trying to build back and reposition our Commonwealth, now more than ever is the time where Democrats, Republicans, liberals, and conservatives need to come together for the good of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is facing mountainous challenges that we need to be collectively working on together. And this is not something that is helpful in that process.
You know, I get the feeling, Representative, that depending on which candidate a person voted for or where they stand politically, they see this issue differently. In fact, we've got the question here from a Millersville University student, says, what lies are you talking about? Because it seems to me there were interviews and videos of people stating they were told to throw away certain votes. We also had a call from a listener who said, just because the courts wouldn't hear cases doesn't mean that it didn't happen. I mean, those sound like people who have bought into what, you know, have been described as lies. So what lies are you talking about?
Well, you know, I am a Millersville grad and a proud alum of Millersville. So I'm glad to see political participation from a Millersville student. But I'm talking about the lies that the election was fraudulent. It wasn't. Take here in Philadelphia. You know, there were questions about the election results in Philadelphia and how many votes the former president got and how many votes our current president got. Well, one of the election officials is a Republican. He was the one speaking on, but he, as an authority on the election. He was there, you know, in Commissioner Al Schmidt, there watching all of those votes be counted. So there's been no evidence of any fraud in the city of the first class during this election. It just hasn't happened. Court after court, whether they were democratically appointed a jurist or Republican appointed jurist, some being appointed by President Trump himself, they threw out these cases. So those are the lies we're talking about, that there were election irregularities that somehow would have affected the outcome. But again, I come back to this, to all of the folks out there that are listening that are like, oh, well, you know, the court wouldn't hear this part of the court. Okay, so why didn't those patriots stand up on swearing in day and vow not to take their oath of office until this was done? My friends who called, many of them call themselves patriots, many of them who stood up, where were they on swearing in day where they took the oath of office to get sworn in themselves on an election that they say was fraudulent? Why hasn't anybody asked those kinds of questions? If you believe the election is fraudulent, how did you take the oath of office?
Representative, we're almost out of time. One thing that you mentioned very early on, you talked about those members of the legislature who may have been in Washington on January 6th. As far as I know, so far only Senator Doug Mastriano has been identified as being there and admitted that he was there. He said he left before the violence started. I know there was a former state legislator that was there. Is there any evidence that there were other legislators that were in Washington that day and may have even gone into the Capitol?
No, I'm not. I am personally not aware of any other evidence, and I would never besmirch the character of any of my colleagues to say that I have or in possession of evidence that I am not in possession of. That's not who I am. That's not my character. But we saw the videos and the Facebook post of the senator who was there. But this also goes beyond just that day. It's still happening. They're still hearing after hearing, stirring the pot on these lies. That needs to also end. I'm all about efficiency. I'm all about making sure that electoral processes in the future can continue to be as safe and secure as this one. But anything that is stood up and that is used as propaganda, anything that masquerades as legitimate work, when in essence all it is continuing to spread lies, should be stopped and should be stopped at once. It's not good for the Commonwealth. It's not good for our democracy.
Democratic State Representative Jordan Harris of Philadelphia. Representative Harris, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Are you concerned about being able to afford health care? If so, you're not alone. As a new statewide poll in Pennsylvania found that more than half of respondents struggled to afford health care in the past year. Paying for future treatment is a big worry for most as well. Joining us is Antoinette Krause, founding director of the Pennsylvania Health Access Network, which had a role in this poll. Ms. Krause, two of the most significant findings of this survey is that half struggled to afford health care in the last year, and three quarters worry about affording it in the future. Now, it comes during the worst pandemic in 100 years. How has the coronavirus pandemic influenced people's thinking about affordability?
Yeah, thanks. And it's good to be here this morning. You know, in the midst of the largest public health crisis we've ever faced, as folks are, you know, worried about losing their jobs and having less disposable income, we're just seeing folks really struggle to afford health insurance coverage, right? We did a poll in Pennsylvania, and, you know, on top of cutting pills in half, you know, skipping doctor's appointments, folks are also really worried that they're going to get sick with COVID and not be able to afford the treatments they need. So, you know, we're worried people are going to delay seeking care for COVID as we see them seeking or delaying care for other critical medical appointments.
Were any of these results a surprise? I mean, coming during, as you said, the worst health crisis in at least 100 years, people talking about being able to afford health care. I mean, it was a concern before the pandemic. Now it seems to be even worse, more of a worry. But you add in that people are concerned about being able to afford health care if they would get sick from COVID. I mean, is any of this really a surprise?
No, I mean, I think it's what we've been seeing, you know, for years. Folks have been worried about rising healthcare costs. We know, you know, people in Pennsylvania have delayed care because of costs. They're cutting prescription drugs, you know, in half. You know, the pandemic, no surprise, is just making that worse. And I think what really concerns us is, you know, people are saying, you know, I might not be able to get treatment for COVID because I'm really worried about that medical bill that will result, right? At a time where I may have lost my job or I'm already struggling to make ends meet because of the economy that we're facing at this moment.
Well, I want to go over some of the findings here, and it touches on what you've been describing here. 44% of Pennsylvanians say they encounter one or more cost-related interruptions to getting health care during the last year, including they skipped needed dental care, delayed going to the doctor or having a procedure done, cut pills in half, skipped doses of medicine, or did not fill a prescription, avoided going to the doctor or having a procedure done altogether, skipped a recommended medical test or treatment, had problems getting mental health care. I mean, what that says is that there may be people who are doing some of those things because we're afraid of affordability, but also afraid to go, you know, very early on, especially to the hospital or to their doctor. What it says is when we do come out of this pandemic, that we may have a population that is going to be a lot less healthy. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're already seeing the fear of folks, you know, not going to the doctor because they're worried of contracting COVID, right? I know from my own personal experience, you know, my parents are older, you know, they put off going to get, you know, colonoscopies and mammograms this year because they were already scared, you know, that they could get sick if they go to the doctor's office, right? And now you have this other burden, right? You're worried about getting that bill that will hit you. I think one of the most fascinating things about, you know, what we found is, you know, things are so polarized right now in Harrisburg and DC about, you know, what we should be doing to tackle this. You know, there was overwhelming support, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, you know, they want their elected officials to address this issue no matter what party line or party affiliation, you know, they identify with, right? And people want us to tackle rising prescription drug costs. They want to make healthcare more accessible and affordable and open up more coverage options and really tackle this, right? So at a time where folks are, you know, trying to figure out what to do, there's just this overwhelming support, you know, for our elected officials to take these issues head on right now.
Well, those what you're talking about, your survey showed that there is an overwhelming number of people across party lines that support expanding health insurance options so that everyone can afford quality coverage. Make it easier to switch insurers if a health plan drops your doctor. Show what a fair price would be for specific procedures. Ensure patients can't be charged out-of-network prices if they encounter an out-of-network provider through no fault of their own. These are things that all were proposed or people were looking at before, government was looking at before, I guess what one of the surprises here is that, if it is a surprise, is that all of those percentages are over 90% of people who support those things. Are lawmakers, are they aware of this? Are people in government aware that over 90% support those things?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're starting to see some action, right? We've seen the Biden administration start to do things to increase affordability for folks who, you know, are enrolling in the health insurance marketplace. You know, we've seen there's bills to kind of tackle prescription drug costs that have been introduced in Harrisburg by both Republicans and Democrats. But I think, you know, we see a lot of action, bills introduced, you know, in Harrisburg. We have thousands of bills introduced every year. But, you know, it's time to actually move these forward because the people of Pennsylvania want it. You know, people shouldn't be worried about, you know, putting food on the table or affording their prescription drugs. And I would emphasize, you know, this was a statewide poll, and this issue is actually even, you know, more prevalent in rural communities. So it's every part of, you know, the Commonwealth. It's, you know, every voter, no matter what they, what party they're affiliated with. So it's really kind of this moment where, you know, we really want people to step up and take action.
Antoinette, something else that I found significant is people are concerned about the future, medical costs when they're older, saying that health insurance will become too expensive, medical costs in the event of a serious illness or accident. And, of course, cost of prescription drugs is always, of needed prescription drugs, I should say, is always at the top of the list. I mean, we have so many things to worry about today. It's obvious that many Pennsylvanians are worried about their future and being able to pay for their health care.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as someone that has older parents, I often tell the story of my mom. She has epilepsy, pre-existing condition. You know, my dad actually delayed his retirement despite his own health issues because, you know, the prescription drugs for my mother were so expensive, right? They couldn't afford to go without health coverage, to wait for Medicare, or even how they would pay prescription drug costs. So it's really, you know, how do we tackle this to make sure, you know, when people reach those golden years and they're able to retire, that they're not, you know, worried or, you know, having to take on second jobs to be able to afford the care they need, prescription drugs, or, you know, even with Medicare, you know, you still can get large hospital bills or you're worried about the cost of long-term care. So, you know, it's really important and impacts all of us, you know, young, old, or in between. I think we're all worried about it on some level. And that's what our polling shows.
Here's, and I have to say that we only have about a minute left. Terry asked, as you talk about rising cost of medical care during COVID, I was just wondering why going to the doctor or ER for COVID care is so expensive. I went to the ER because I was feeling like I may have contracted COVID. I had to pay $400. Once I got the test, I was negative, so I paid the $400 for a negative test. There's a lot that is supposed to be free, but apparently not all of it.
Yeah, so I would encourage folks, you know, to get COVID testing if you have COVID symptoms to go and get care. I think what happens is if you don't have that COVID diagnosis or, you know, even if you do and you need some related or unrelated care, you know, that's when you could get hit with that medical bill, right? Or, you know, you still might have that huge copay to go to the emergency room. So, you know, I think that there's multiple layers, but folks should go and get tested and coverage because, you know, that should be limited. But again, it's the care associated with it that many folks get stuck in.
Antoinette Krause is founding director of the Pennsylvania Health Access Network. We have a copy or a link to that survey if you'd like to learn more about it on our website, WITF.org. Antoinette, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.